Good afternoon or good morning for those of you on the West. Welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Nicole Cooney and I will moderate today's seminar. Today's topic is measuring life cycle impacts of freight transportation emissions. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you will need to mute your computer speakers or else you will be hearing your audio over the computer as well. Today we have three presentations given by Mikhail Chester of Arizona State University, John Davies of the Federal Highway Administration's Office of Natural Environment, Frank Gallivan from ICF International, Jeff Houck of the Federal Administration's Resource Center, and Chris Porter of Cambridge Systematics. Dr. Mikhail Chester is an assistant professor in civil, environmental, and sustainable engineering at Arizona State University, where he runs a research laboratory focused on transportation life cycle assessment and infrastructure resilience to climate change. Dr. Chester has worked with a variety of public and private passenger and freight agencies to develop energy and environmental assessments of transportation systems, including infrastructure, vehicle and energy production processes, in addition to vehicle operation. He is currently leading three National Science Foundation projects to study how the design of infrastructure is vulnerable to extreme heat and flooding. John Davies is an environmental protection specialist with Federal Highway's Office of Natural Environment. His work focuses on tools, methods, and research supporting greenhouse gas analysis and policy development. Before coming to Federal Highway, John worked on climate issues with EPA's Office of Transportation and Air Quality. John holds a master's in regional planning from the University of North Carolina. Frank Gallivan is a transportation and sustainability planner with ICF International. He specializes in the design and implementation of analytical tools to promote better decision-making in transportation planning, design, maintenance, and operations. Frank holds a master's of city planning from UC Berkeley. Jeff Houck is an air quality specialist with Federal Highways Resource Center in Lakewood, Colorado. Jeff works on issues related to highway project air quality analysis, transportation conformity, and climate change. He has 30 years of experience with transportation air quality issues at EPA and Federal Highway, and has a degree in chemical engineering from Michigan State. Chris Porter is a principal of Cambridge Systematics with 18 years of experience in air quality, energy and greenhouse gas analyses, transportation and land use, and performance measurement. He has led a study for the National Renewable Energy Laboratory on the effects of travel demand management in the built environment on energy use, and was the lead author of the U.S. Department of Transportation report to Congress on transportation's contribution to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. He has supported state and regional CHG inventories and reduction plans, including both passenger and freight strategies in Connecticut, Florida, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Oregon. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your questions to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I will start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. If we run out of time or are unable to answer all the questions, we will attempt to get written responses from the presenters to unanswered questions. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with the recording and a transcript. I will notify all attendees once these materials are posted online. Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credits for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you are attending with a group of people, you must type your first and last name into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. For those of you who are not AICP members but would like to receive PDH credits for this webinar, please note that Federal Highway does not formally offer PDHs. However, it may be possible to receive PDHs for your participation in Talking Freight if you are able to self-certify. To possibly receive PDHs, please download the agenda from the file download box and submit this agenda to your respective licensing agency. Finally, I encourage everyone to please also download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit this form to me after you have filled it out. I'm now going to turn it over to Mikhail Chester of Arizona State University to get started. Mikhail?
Hi guys. Thank you. So today, I'd like to sort of kick this off by giving an overview of environmental life cycle assessment of freight transportation services, which is a field that has slowly emerged, I would say, over the past 10 years. The objective here is to give you all an overview of, how we're thinking about developing life cycle assessments about freight. And what we tend to find is significant in the life cycle and what we suggest to do about it. So I would like to, start maybe 10 years ago, roughly, when freight LCA started to emerge, and then move into today and the types of analyses that we're doing today focused on vehicle infrastructure and energy production components. So to get you thinking about life cycle assessment, I'd like to start by making sure that we all are thinking about transportation as a service. So I think we often will sort of move towards thinking about transportation as the movement of vehicles, which is obviously a necessity. But when we think about it as a service, we tend to think about the ancillary systems that are needed to support the movement of vehicles. So transportation systems, whether passenger and freight, all require three fundamental elements, which are the vehicles, a right-of-way, and terminal capacity. And those translate in some ways to the life cycle processes that I would bin into either vehicle manufacturing and maintenance, infrastructure construction, rehabilitation, maintenance, and operation, as well as energy production. And from a life cycle perspective, what we're trying to do is connect the sort of cradle to grave, as it's described, or the processes that are needed from the extraction of raw materials, the processing of those raw materials, the movement of those raw materials, turning them into something like a vehicle or infrastructure, ultimately using those materials or those vehicles and infrastructure components, and then finally disposing of them at the end. So there are, I would characterize three major categories of life cycle processes that we're interested in. Again, the vehicle infrastructure and energy production side. I think it's pretty intuitive to think about vehicle and infrastructure. We see those on a day-to-day basis. We're surrounded by them. Energy production tends to be a significant component, and I'm going to show you results in a little bit, and you can see how significant this is. But this is the concept that to use energy, you need to invest energy, meaning that in order to have a gallon of gasoline or diesel or any other form of energy in a vehicle, additional energy is triggered in the supply chain, and that's for the extraction of those fuels, the processing of those fuels, and the movement of those fuels to their final destination where they're put into the vehicle. And, when I started doing LCA about 10 years ago, the rough number was that for every 100 gallons of gasoline in a car, about 16 gallons of gasoline equivalent energy were triggered in the supply chain. Now that number has moved closer to about 30. So for every 100 gallons of gasoline in a passenger automobile, about 30 are triggered in the supply chain. And that's because we've moved towards, heavier oils or sort of like crude oils and tar sands and things like that. So for each of these processes, we also have a supply chain. So it's not just that we have the manufacturing and processing of materials into vehicle infrastructure and energy production processes, but it's also that you have supply chain processes that exist to support those activities as well. And it turns out that these supply chain processes are also significant. For each of these processes, what we do in life cycle assessment, you see the process on the right there in the white box, is we evaluate the energy inputs and the air emission outputs. So energy inputs include, both electricity as well as fuels. Those go into the process, and out of that comes, emissions. And those, today I'm going to focus largely on air emissions, particularly the conventional or criteria pollutants or precursors to criteria pollutants and greenhouse gases, but we could certainly use a life cycle framework to evaluate a variety of other things: water, labor, costs, toxic releases, hazardous pollutants, and so on. We tend to be focused on greenhouse gases. Lately, there's been a lot of LCA work on air emissions and greenhouse gases. And then ultimately, what we can do in LCA is connect those pollutants to human environmental impacts, so moving them from quantities of pollutants to their potential for causing environmental and human health impacts. So a bit more specifics on how we do this. I'll go through each of these processes, major categories of life cycle processes, and give you a little bit more background. So for vehicles, we tend to use modeling platforms like SEMA Pro or the GREET model in the case of passenger, but in the case of freight, we tend to use a European life cycle assessment model called SEMA Pro, where we actually model the manufacturing and maintenance of vehicles under U.S. conditions. Sometimes the manufacturing occurs outside of the U.S. For example, most of the ocean-going vessel fleet is primarily manufactured in Asia, so we're able to model that. The vehicle then comes to the U.S. and it's used and maintained in the U.S. For infrastructure, you'll hear a lot more about this today, so I won't go into too many of the specifics. But for infrastructure, we're generally thinking about modeling the manufacturing of materials, the construction activities, and then the maintenance and rehabilitation cycles. And again, for each of these, the energy that's associated with them and the air emissions that come out. Pallet was one of the first two, first tools to do this, the pavement life cycle assessment tool for energy and economic impacts, developed out of UC Berkeley in the mid-2000s. From what I understand, the FHWA infrastructure carbon estimator, which I'm excited to hear more about soon, build somewhat on that knowledge, and so I won't go into details there since it'll be covered. And then, you know, my lab here has been developing a city and regional network life cycle assessment tool to be able to evaluate these materials, construction activities, and maintenance rehabilitation cycles for an entire roadway network. So you could do this for a state, you could do this for a region, you could do this for a city. And on the energy production side, I would say the state-of-the-art is the U.S. DOE Argonne's GREET model, which is the fuel cycle model that we typically rely on for U.S. energy use and transportation. And then supply chains have typically been evaluated with Carnegie Mellon's economic input-output life cycle assessment model. So this allows us to look upstream into the supply chain and evaluate the energy and environmental impacts associated with so much economic activity. From these sorts of approaches, you early on saw results like this. So this is showing grams per ton mile of CO2, NOx, PM10, CO, and SO2 across rail, road, and air modes, freight modes, where, you know, you see a consistent pattern emerge, which is rail is the lowest, followed by road, followed by air. The uncertainty bounds capture a variety of different vehicles and different parameter uncertainties associated with this model. So this came out in 2007. It was the first rigorous freight LCA that was performed. Interestingly, when you flip the results, instead of normalizing per ton mile, you normalize per dollar of value of the goods that are transported. You see opposite results, meaning rail is the largest, road is in the middle, and air is the lowest. So air moves high-value goods, and rail very, very low-value goods. So this is where we started with freight LCA about 8 years ago. And those were life cycle results. And here you see the life cycle results broken down in a bit more detail. So now you're seeing the fuel combustion as light gray, the vehicle manufacturing and maintenance is black, the infrastructure is white, and the energy production as the darker gray. And the way to read this is the bars are showing you the percentage of the bars on the previous figure here, and what is contributing to them. So for example, if you look at PM10 emissions for air or for road, you see that a lot of those emissions are associated with the infrastructure. So the infrastructure is contributing a large portion of PM emissions. And this is the sort of insight that we desire to acquire using life cycle assessment. It gives us a bit more information about where major impacts are occurring from these ancillary services that are associated with freight transport. So, you know, then we could say, well, you know, there's a lot of PM emissions coming out of roads. What do we do about this? And I'll get to that. more recently, sort of where we are today, we've been much more rigorous about the components that we're including in our life cycle assessment. So here is a table showing you all the different life cycle processes denoted by bullets that we are assessing associated with trucking, air, marine, and rail. So you have far more detail in terms of what's going in, everything from the de-icing fluids on airplanes, herbicide use on roadways and railroad tracks, the manufacturing of vehicles all over the world, and the production of fuel under a variety of different fuel pathways. And again, for each of these bullets, we're trying to understand the energy requirements and greenhouse gas and other air emissions that are associated with them. And here's some results for California that use that more robust framework. So this is the life cycle energy use in the top left and emissions as metric tons per kilometer in California. So this is a study that I led for the California Air Resources Board as part of AB 32. But we tried to characterize what the life cycle emissions were with this more robust framework. And again, you see here the gray being the operation, the tailpipe of the vehicle, so to speak, that it constitutes a large portion of the life cycle results, but not necessarily the entire portion of it for some of these modes. So what you see is that certain pollutants tend to appear fairly significantly in the life cycle. So SO2 tends to be one that we see in both passenger and freight, and that's largely because we've done a really good job cleaning up the tailpipe of vehicles by doing low carbon fuels, but we haven't done commensurately as much cleaning up the SO2 emissions from electricity generation, and electricity appears everywhere in the life cycle of these modes. So, those are the sorts of insights that we're getting with the more robust framework that we're using now. What we find in California is infrastructure tends not to be a huge, huge piece of the puzzle. It tends to be largely vehicle manufacturing and energy production in the life cycle, in addition to the tailpipe. And that leads us to questions about not only the per kilometer or mile results, which I've been showing you, but what does this mean sort of systematically across the region? So now I'm showing you the life cycle results for California, and what you'll see is, as you many of you are experts who probably already kind of know this, is that the heavy duty and medium heavy duty trucks are responsible for the vast majority of ton miles of goods moved, and therefore they're responsible for the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions in that state, which is probably true in other states as well. So rail and rail plus truck intermodal modes are very small fractions. So, this leads us to questions of, what do we do about this? Obviously, we should be targeting freight. And when we target freight, now we can think about, we should be targeting trucks. And now when we target trucks, we should be thinking about doing it across these life cycle processes. So it's not that we have to specifically focus on the tailpipe of vehicles, but we can move into not only strategies for the tailpipe of vehicles, but what those strategies that reduce the emissions at the tailpipe of vehicles do to other life cycle processes, particularly infrastructure and energy production. So, hopefully what you can see with the life cycle is that it gives us a sense of what a strategy does in the sort of interdependentness of the system, meaning that if we make trucks more energy efficient, if we improve their miles per gallon, then we're also going to get benefits on the energy production side. No matter if you're going to have to produce less energy, so you're going to get less impacts upstream. Similarly, if you reduce the impacts associated with infrastructure construction, or if you re-engineer infrastructure to be slightly different, through maybe reduced material use, or smoother surfaces, more stiffness, those sorts of strategies, you might have positive benefits on the vehicle operation side, which then would translate to the energy production side. So those are the connections that we're trying to make across the life cycle. It's not that those components that I showed you before are interdependent. They're very much dependent on each other. Going forward, my last slide here, and I'll finish up, we've been asking what it would take to get vehicles down to policy goals or to, certain levels that we're sort of starting to think about. So in California, 1990 levels of greenhouse gas emissions are below that. And then by 2050, 20% of 1990 greenhouse gas levels. So we're positioning the life cycle results And here I'm showing annual greenhouse gas emissions over time and what would happen under different technology changes and different fuel changes, and whether or not that gets us to those policy goals by a certain year. And, you know, what we're seeing in our analysis is, well, you know, you basically need to have zero emission vehicle technologies or zero emission fuels to get close to the 2050 policy goals of 80% below 1990 levels. And, you know, while we do this with CO2, we can do this with other pollutants as well. And connecting this back to the life cycle, that gives us a more robust way of thinking about this because, you know, we're starting to sort of piece together that strategies that occur within the state to meet these sort of policy goals have effects beyond the state. And, you know, that's the result of life cycle processes that don't necessarily follow geopolitical boundaries. With that, I'll end. All of this information is available on our lab's website, transportationlca.org, and I'm happy to take questions by email in addition to the questions in the seminar here later today. So thank you.
Thank you, Mikhail. Now we will move on to John Davies of the Federal Highway Office of Natural Environment.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Nicole. And thanks to Mikhail for providing a really great overview of the whole sort of life cycle of world here. And I'm going to drill down and hopefully talk a bit more about a tool that FHWA has addressed, developed to specifically address the infrastructure piece. One point to make that's I think really important is that greenhouse gases are different from criteria pollutants in that their impacts are cumulative and to that extent in addition to being cumulative they're not locationally specific and recognizing that the greenhouse gas emissions are different from the criteria of pollutants space, FHWA started thinking about this issue, and we recognized that there would be value in developing a tool that would help FHWA both evaluate the emissions associated with projects that we help fund and also transportation agencies to evaluate the projects that they plan and build. So anyway, it's all to say that recognizing that if one of the reasons that agencies are building projects is to help offset the impact of operational emissions, but part of the entire sort of life cycle analysis is being able to capture the emissions that are associated with infrastructure itself. So in terms of just the state of practice, FHWA had really not thought a whole lot about this issue until a few years ago. The greenhouse gas analysis is not an uncommon thing. A majority of states have climate action plans of some sort, and most large MPOs are involved in emissions analysis, and as part of that, many of them do greenhouse gas analysis. Some states have requirements to analyze a greenhouse gas emission, but it's all to say that almost the vast majority of all of that analysis is focused on the tailpipe, and only one state has requirements for analysis of the infrastructure piece. So recognizing that, we thought, well, it seems like a sort of a blind spot that transportation agencies don't really have a very good sort of a tool to address the infrastructure that they're ultimately responsible for. And maybe just as critically, what we noticed was that there was growing interest in with this administration in the ability to address greenhouse gas emissions, as part of the NEPA process. And the Council on Environmental Quality, which is responsible for NEPA, has been talking about this for some time, and they developed a draft guidance. And the early versions of this have envisioned basically an implied requirement for certain large federal actions to be able to start to characterize the emissions that are associated. And so it's all to say that we recognize that this is very likely to to be a requirement at some point. And again, there's not a really good way to be able to address that. So with all that in mind, about 2.5 or 3 years ago, we partnered with ICF International to start developing a tool that would be simple and hopefully useful for practitioners to start to be able to address emissions at sort of a pre-engineering level. We looked around and we found that there were as Mikhail indicated, I mean, there are a number of tools that are available, but a lot of them require fairly detailed inputs. And we wanted to come up with something that planners and NEPA analysts would be able to to be able to use and potentially use with when often really detailed data wasn't necessarily available. And ICF did some very, very I think thoughtful work in coming up with this, and I'd like to turn it over to Frank Gallivan to talk about sort of what his team was able to come up with.
Okay, thanks, John. So I'm going to be going through the capabilities of the tool and showing you some screenshots and kind of getting you familiar with what the tool looks like and how it functions. I'm not going to spend any time on the data sources or the kind of detailed analyses that went into creating the tool. I will just say that we did rely heavily on the palette model that Mikhail mentioned, as well as NCHRP fuel factors data and a couple of databases of road projects for quantities of materials. For those that are interested in more about that, there's more than you could ever want in the documentation of the tool on the FHWA website. But getting into the capabilities of the tool, we are talking today about freight, but I just wanted to make it clear that the tool does much more than freight. It's designed to address every type of surface-based transportation. So there are modules that calculate greenhouse gas emissions from construction of roadways and parking facilities, public transportation, infrastructure, bridges, and bike and pedestrian facilities as well. A little bit about the way that we address the life cycle calculations in the tool. As Mikhail said, we're accounting for emissions from materials, from construction activities, and from maintenance and rehabilitation. We just categorize those a little bit differently in the tool in terms of upstream energy and emissions and then direct energy and emissions. So the upstream energy and emissions are those that come from the materials that go into those facilities, so raw materials extraction, materials production, transportation to site, and then we also include chemical reactions in producing cement. Those produce CO2 emissions. And then with the direct emissions, we have the construction equipment, so that's fuel used in transportation materials to the site, fuel used in the construction equipment on site, and then fuel used in routine maintenance of those facilities, so snow removal, vegetation, and other types of routine maintenance activities like stripes, all incorporated in the calculations of the tool. We also have a range of mitigation strategies that can be applied in the tool. So the tool works, first of all, to inventory the emissions that occurred from your basic action of constructing or maintaining facility, but then we also allow you to experiment with potential mitigation strategies to reduce the energy use and greenhouse gas emissions associated with those activities. So there are mitigation strategies in terms of alternative fuels that you can use in construction vehicles as well as maintenance vehicles, using different types of materials recycling, like in-place roadway recycling, actually incorporating recycled materials from other sites into your construction, and then using a preventive maintenance routine that can reduce the overall amount of energy that you have to put into maintaining your roadway over time. And the tool, using a tool breaks down into six basic steps. These are actual screenshots from the tool. This is an Excel-based tool. It's fairly simple to navigate and to use. There's only three or four sheets maybe that you need to interact with. We ask for basic inputs to start with: location of your state, the number of years that you want to consider for the life cycle emissions of your particular project, and then some basic information about the extent of your transportation project or your network. The tool works at any geographical scale that you want to analyze. So you could be doing a project on a 10-mile roadway or looking at an entire regional transportation system. In the next step, you input information about the construction and maintenance activities that you foresee as part of your project. Our most basic input there is lane miles by facility type. So you would input, if you're doing building a new road, you would input the number of lane miles of new roadway in each of those seven facility types you see there on the left, divided by rural and urban, and then arterial collectors and interstates. In the next step, we ask for some information about construction delays. So the tool does actually include calculations to estimate the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that could occur additionally because of roadway delay caused by construction activities. And there's, if you want to look at that, you can input a couple of simple data points about project days of lane closure and then the extent of the facility. Step four would be to input mitigation strategies, and you can look at both a baseline level of deployment if you consider that a lot of, for example, state departments of transportation are already using a high proportion of recycled materials in their projects. So you may input what you're currently doing in baseline deployment and then increase that in your planned deployment in order to understand how increasing the level of deployment of that strategy could affect your greenhouse gas emissions. And then in step five, we're showing you the results. So results are presented both in terms of energy use in BTUs and in greenhouse gas emissions. And they're broken down in terms of the different basic facility types, the roadway, bridges, rail, bus, bicycle, and pedestrian, as well as by life cycle emissions category. We've also got some nice bar charts in the tool to help you visualize that. And then a final step, if you did want to look at the construction delay component, and we also have a calculation that will estimate the impact of pavement smoothness, as Mikhail talked about, which can contribute to increasing vehicle fuel economy and thereby reducing greenhouse gas emissions. These are the only components of the tool that actually get at the vehicle operations part of the transportation system. But because they are so intrinsically linked to the construction activities themselves, we did want to include those. And that's it. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff Houck to talk about a case study of the tool's use.
Thanks, Frank. When we, as we were developing and testing the tool, we also developed a few case studies. This one happens to represent a hypothetical port project. The project is to improve access to a small port that sees about 500 trucks per day. I have a couple of screenshots coming up so you can visualize what this looks like, but I'll describe it here. There are deficient bridges on one roadway going into the port, so trucks have to take kind of a roundabout route through town to access the port. In addition, because of space restrictions at the port, the trucks have to line up and idle along city streets while they wait their turn to go into the port. So this project is designed to fix those two problems. So the project would widen the southern access roadway, reconstruct two bridges to be able to handle the weight of heavy trucks, and also build truck parking at the port so that trucks would no longer have to idle along city streets. That in turn would require relocation of about half a mile of rail access line to the port. So in this example, we do two types of analysis. We use the infrastructure carbon estimator to account for the construction and maintenance emissions associated with the project itself. But we also use EPA's MOVES emissions model to calculate the changes in truck emissions. Because we'll have less idling and a shorter access route into the port, we can capture the change in truck emissions using EPA's MOVES model. So here's the no-build scenario. In this aerial shot, you can see a major highway coming up from the south, and then it basically dead ends at another highway going into town. And this dashed red line shows the route that trucks currently take going into the port. The solid yellow line shows the area where trucks are idling alongside the road while they wait their turn to get into the port. And then you can see another highway coming into the port area from the south, and I've pointed out where the two substandard bridges are located that would need to be rebuilt as part of the project. And then finally, the dashed blue line going kind of across the middle of the picture shows the rail access line into the port. So this next photograph shows the project. So we're widening the southern access road and rebuilding those bridges so that trucks can come into the port area from that direction instead of looping up and then coming through town. We're building a truck parking lot at the port, and because of that, we're slightly relocating the rail terminus of the port. So that's our hypothetical project. This is a real place, but it's just a fictitious project that we use to illustrate the capabilities of the tool. So, you know, using the tool and going through the spreadsheet and filling out the different cells that account for the road work we're going to do and the bridge work we're going to do and the rail work we're going to do, along with maintaining the existing system. For the no-build scenario, there are about 56 tons of carbon dioxide a year associated with maintaining the existing roadway and rail system. In the build scenario, there are about 223 tons of carbon dioxide a year, accounting for constructing the new infrastructure plus maintaining the new and the existing infrastructure. So in using the tool for this kind of build-no-build comparison, the no-action alternative only includes maintenance of the roadways that are being used, and the build scenario includes construction of the new stuff plus maintenance of the new stuff and the old stuff. So the net difference between those two scenarios is 167 tons per year. Using EPA's MOVES model to estimate truck emissions, the no-build emissions are close to 5,000 tons per year of carbon dioxide, and that's an average between 2020 and 2040. The build scenario goes down to 723 tons, and that's because the trucks are taking a shorter route into the port, and also we've eliminated all that idling by building a truck parking area. So using the information about the construction load and the maintenance load along with the emission savings from the trucks, we can calculate a payback period. When are the emission savings from the trucks enough to offset the emissions that were accrued in building the infrastructure? So the total net change in emissions over the 20-year life of the project is 167 tons times 20 years, or about 3,300 tons. The on-road emissions benefit is about 4,000 tons per year, so the payback period for this project is about 10 months. And after 10 months, we start to see a net benefit from this construction project at the port. So this is just one example of how this type of tool can be used. I'm just going to close out this session of the presentation. If you want more information about the tool, here's the link where you can download the spreadsheet tool. There's also a document that's a combined user guide and technical report. It includes the information that Frank discussed about the sources of information behind the tool and the calculations within the tool and so on. At FHWA, John Davies and I are the contacts for this tool, and then here's Frank's contact information at ICF. And that's it for us.
Thank you, Jeff. We'll now move on to Chris Porter of Cambridge Systematics. Chris?
Great, thank you. Okay. So my title is about life cycle emissions assessment from freight vehicles, but I'm not really going to be talking explicitly about the life cycle components as our previous presenters did. I'm really just going to be talking about freight's contributions to emissions and strategies for reducing those emissions and really kind of try to paint a picture from a number of recent studies on freight and emissions. So I'm just going to start off with some background about freight's contribution and forecasts, and then I'll talk about strategies related to vehicle and fuel technology, operational strategies, and also demand management and mode shift, and finally draw a few conclusions according to kind of different scopes of different agencies or actors have control over. So this is from EPA's National Emissions Inventory, and it shows surface transportation emissions, including light-duty vehicles, which are the kind of the blue or the light blue or turquoise components, and then heavy-duty vehicles. So these are contributions to fine particulate matter and oxides of nitrogen in 2011. And this shows that trucks are responsible for about half of all PM 2.5 emissions and just over a third of NOx emissions. Rail and marine collectively make up about 20% of each pollutant emissions. And so collectively, surface freight is responsible for the majority of both pollutants from surface transportation. And nearly all of this comes from diesel engines. This is actually something that Dr. Chester talked about in much more detail, but this just shows, operating the direct emissions and then upstream emissions from fuel processing, fuel production and delivery, which are generally directly proportional to the direct emissions from the actual operations of the transport vehicles. And those upstream emissions add about 22% in our calculations using the GREET model in 2011. This can vary depending on the specific production pathway of the fuel. And carbon dioxide emissions, the primary greenhouse gas component, are going to be proportional to energy use. This chart also shows energy use by mode. An average truck is about 10 times more intensive per ton mile than rail or water, but this is a little misleading since most rail and water movements also involve truck and intermodal handling emissions at each end of the trip. So, and they also may be more circuitous than on-road truck routes. So when you average that all in, overall rail and water are typically about three times more efficient than trucking. But again, this varies depending on the distance of the freight moved. You're going to have more relative benefits over a longer distance where you get more of the benefits of the line haul of the rail. And you can also see that air is very intensive, energy intensive per ton mile, but it really carries only a very small fraction of ton miles. This is, again, showing direct and upstream emissions, but this is comparing fuel types for common fuels and showing relative to green emissions from conventional gasoline. You can see that diesel is about 15% less carbon intensive than gasoline or corn ethanol, and soy-based biodiesel with a 20% blend of biofuel is about 25% less intensive than gasoline on a life cycle basis. For compressed natural gas, the direct emissions are even lower, but there are more upstream emissions largely to methane leakage. So overall, the fuel cycle emissions are pretty comparable to diesel. I also want to point out that these numbers, there's a fair amount of uncertainty in some of the estimates of the upstream emissions, especially for biofuels, the contributions of land use change, as well as methane leakage in the natural gas production cycle. So these numbers may be changing and probably will change in current and future versions of the life cycle models. This paints a picture of where freight is projected to go in terms of overall growth, which is one of the drivers of energy and emissions. This is from the Annual Energy Outlook, The AEO projects truck vehicle miles of travel to grow at nearly 2% per year. Rail freight is expected to remain level and domestic shipping to decline slightly. Of course, you know, these could change due to various changes in economic activity and the structure of freight and manufacturing industries and other factors. Counteracting these trends, truck fuel efficiency is expected to improve by 14% in the future due to the 2014 to 2018 heavy-duty vehicle greenhouse gas emission standards adopted by EPA and NHTSA. Rail and shipping efficiency are also expected to improve by about 15 to 20% over the next three decades. So you can see that that's going to help it'll basically, it's not enough, the efficiency improvements are not going to be enough to counteract the forecast growth in terms of overall energy use. So we don't have a national emissions forecast, so of non, aside from the energy and greenhouse gas emissions, of criteria pollutants. So this is an example from Connecticut, an inventory that we did with our partners. And you can see that comparing 2020 versus 2009, we projected a 25% increase in truck VMT compared to about a 50% reduction in NOx and over 80% reduction in PM. And that is reflecting the emission standards that were phased in over the 2007 to 2010 period by EPA for trucks, and as well as on locomotives, the new Tier 3, Tier 4 emission standards from locomotives. You can also see that over the long run through 2040, the increase in VMT is expected to start to kind of level out those emissions benefits over time. So next, I'm going to talk about some control strategies. Again, talking about technology, operations, and then the potential for mode shift. So this table lists some of the more effective technology strategies and provides an assessment of their effectiveness and cost effectiveness, which we typically measure in dollars per ton of pollutant reduced. And just for reference, $10,000 per ton is a pretty common reference point. If it costs less than that, it's considered to be cost effective, and more than that, not so. That's for NOx. It would be a different scale for particulate matter. So extended idling, which occurs while the driver is resting but needs to keep running the truck to run the power systems, it's responsible for a large portion of emissions from long-haul trucks and expected to get larger, making up maybe half of all NOx emissions from long-haul trucks by 2020. So some of the strategies to control extended idling include truck stop electrification or vehicle-based strategies, including installation of auxiliary power units. And those can be pretty effective in addition to saving fuel, potentially leading to a net cost savings to the vehicle operator. Inspection and maintenance programs are basically a way of making sure that vehicles continue to meet the emission standards that they were built to, which is going to be really important for the new clean vehicles. And all 2013 and later model trucks will be equipped with the so-called OBD2 systems that will identify trucks needing maintenance through remote monitoring. So that's going to be an important benefit. This can be a cost-effective way of controlling emissions. Another strategy is a natural, conversion to a natural gas, which some people have been doing recently just because of the cost difference between the fuels. The pollutant benefits are pretty limited given the new diesel controls, but you do get some greenhouse gas savings, as I showed a couple of slides ago. Drayage trucks are trucks that are used for short-haul goods movements around ports and terminals. These are typically older and higher emitting than average vehicles and often can be cost-effectively controlled through accelerated retirement or retrofitting or rebuild of engines. Since these are local routes, they're also favorable to alternative fuel application. But over the long run, this is going to be a less effective strategy as our new trucks become cleaner and those get phased into the older operations. You can also retrofit trucks in use in higher speed applications with products to improve aerodynamics and rolling resistance, such as the SmartWay certified products and fairings, rolling resistance tires, etc. And then there are numerous technologies for retrofitting diesel engines with pollution controls. The reduction potential and cost effectiveness really varies a lot, depending on the technology, the vehicle characteristics, how it's used. So it's difficult to summarize, except to say that in certain applications where there's a lot of pollution or a lot of emissions and a lot of exposure to local population, that these can be very effective and cost-effective control strategies. Some strategies also directed at rail and marine emissions. And for example, operations at rail switching yards actually make up a pretty significant fraction of the rail emissions inventory. And these emissions can be reduced by up to 90% by repowering older locomotives with new engines, or by replacing with genset locomotives that use hybrid type drivetrains for much better efficiency. And there's also potential for fuel savings from long distance locomotives, although it's somewhat less cost effective. And then around port, if you have a port in your area, there's probably fewer options for reducing emissions from the marine vessels, but reducing speeds is one strategy. Clean fuel for auxiliary engines, and also what's called cold ironing, or providing electricity for the operation of the vessels while in the port, although that can be a fairly expensive strategy. On the operations side, this table lists some strategies that have been considered. I would say in general, the potential is fairly small, either that or localized in nature, or hasn't been well quantified, and can really vary a lot from situation to situation. One point to note is in terms of empty trucks and filling them, that's the backhauls, in Connecticut, we found there are about 7 empty backhauls for every 10 deliveries. So in theory, there's a lot of potential there. However, there's already a lot of load matching that goes on through the private sector, through optimization software, brokerages, et cetera. So, it's not clear what we can do as public sector agencies to kind of promote this further. And it's also difficult to completely eliminate backhauls because flows tend to be unbalanced. In Connecticut, a lot of consumer goods going in, a lot of trash waste going out, and some vehicles, such as fuel tankers, are incompatible with backhauls. Electronic screening allows trucks to bypass inspection stations, makes sense, economic, but it's really pretty much a drop in the bucket and already being done in most places. Information on routing, efficient routing, and truck parking. There's probably most truckers already use some form of navigational aid and may have little ability to change routes. This is another area where probably the overall potential appears modest from a global perspective. Other strategies like delivery restrictions and queue management at ports may actually have important localized benefits for controlling emissions in city centers or around ports or terminals. But again, from a regional or global perspective, may have fairly modest impacts. Finally, moving to demand management and mode shift. This table shows maybe kind of our maximum estimated effectiveness in terms of mode shift percentage if you really implemented the strategy all the way, and also the cost to the public sector. So infrastructure improvements, such as bringing railroads up to double stack clearance and weight standards and improving access to intermodal terminals, potentially could have a pretty significant impact in some markets, but of course are also very, very costly. There are a number of regulatory measures that could encourage mode shift, and in some ways that's because of sort of making trucking more expensive or less attractive, but those might have other undesirable impacts, and it's not likely that a lot of them will be implemented, such as re-regulating freight or size and weight regulations or hours of service regulations. Pricing can also have a modest impact, as well as generating revenue to pay for other improvements. Fuel costs do make an impact on manufacturers and shippers' decisions, but the impact of a unit price increase on freight traffic will be smaller than it will be on passenger traffic, because the shipping cost is just one component, usually a lot less than 10% of the cost of producing a good. So you need a pretty large price signal to really, get much of a mode shift. Short sea shipping is something that's asked about frequently in coastal environments, and it has a lot of challenges, including high costs, low freight density in most markets, and limited congestion along surface roadways. So it really, some tests of it in the U.S. just really hasn't had a lot of viability. This is one of the really key factors in mode shift is what types of commodities you're moving and how far you're using them. So this shows some data that we developed for the National Renewable Energy Laboratory as part of the freight analysis tool, which is available online and can be downloaded for free. But it shows the ton miles of commodities moved by distance band, and it also shows the truck and rail mode shares. The truck is in green, and the rail is in purple. You can see that at short distances, truck dominates, and at longer distance, rail begins to dominate. So you're really looking, in terms of mode shifting, you want to isolate commodities that are in the 250 to 1,500 mile distance band, because that's where you're going to get most of the shiftable, contestable commodities. On the other hand, there's a number of barriers to kind of achieving mode shift in this category. You need commodities that are low value to weight, so that shippers don't really care about the how fast you get them there. They're in a lot of places just lacking intermodal infrastructure or circuitous routing. The cost of drayage at both ends of the trip, rail costs or spotty service. And just an example, again, looking at Connecticut, if you wanted to get freight from the Connecticut coast to the mid-Atlantic coast, you need to route it through Albany, which is really out of the way, or take it on a ferry across Long Island Sound, because there's no crossings of the Hudson below Albany. Again, this is going to vary by market of the country, but you can use this tool to look at different commodities and look at different distance bands and origin destinations if you're interested in looking at freight patterns in your region. So just one, a number of evaluation tools that are available to look at emissions. The emission factor models from MOVES and CARB, or from EPA and CARB, can look at fleet ages, vehicle types, and certain other strategies. EPA produces a number of resources, including the Dray Fleet model, the SmartWay Fleet Performance Model, and the Diesel Emission Quantifier that you can use to look at different fleets or different strategies. USDOT has a freight routing and emissions analysis tool, which can compare landside and waterside routes, as well as the freight analysis framework is not specifically for emissions, but it's a really great data source of freight flows by commodity and mode. I mentioned the freight analysis tool that NREL developed. And then finally, for life cycle emissions, the GREET fleet footprint calculator is the latest tool available from Argonne. There are also a lot of privately developed tools, including carbon footprint calculators, that are really targeted towards private companies measuring the environmental footprint of their supply chain and logistics practices. So finally, just wanted to highlight strategies under various control of various parties. National strategies are things the federal government needs to do, such as emissions and fuel economy regulations. Regional strategies are things that you need to get together with your neighbors and coordinate on. In the Connecticut example, it wouldn't make much sense just for Connecticut to unilaterally improve its rail infrastructure unless surrounding states did so as well. State and metro strategies are things that a typical state air quality agency, MPO, or port authority might be able to implement, such as incentive programs for replacing, retrofitting vehicles with cleaner technology targeted at fleets and individual operators, as well as inspection and maintenance programs. And then carrier-based strategies are things that the private sector can do. And these may be especially attractive if they create a net savings in fuel costs. And even if they do, it may require some public sector finance to help cover the upfront costs to help out smaller operators. And there may be ways to pay these back in fuel savings. So finally, just to recap, so we are expecting significant declines in criteria pollutants, but there's still going to be problem areas, especially where older trucks are operating around ports, around warehousing, distribution hubs, and a lot of opportunities to go in with retrofits and accelerated vehicle retirement to improve emissions in those areas. Also, the growth in freight traffic, if it continues as projected, should balance out some of the emissions improvements. In the long run, a lot of uncertainties in terms of economic structure of production, manufacturing, regulatory issues. Is the federal government going to take more action on emissions, on greenhouse gas emissions, on climate change, as well as fuel prices, either from a market or policy perspective? Regardless, I think, we're going to continue to see challenges in reducing emissions from freight that we need to address at all scales of policy and decision making. That's the end of my presentation. Thank you for listening.